Advertising is based on one thing, happiness. And you know what happiness is? It's the smell of a new car. Those are words from TV's most famous ad man, Don Draper, of the show Mad Men. That show captured an iconic time when advertising was the primary connective tissue between products and consumers. And ads fueled television, print, radio, and influenced how consumers shopped. Today, all of that has changed. Leading media reporter and best-selling author of Googled, Ken Aletta writes about the changing landscape of media and advertising in his new book, Frenemies, The Epic Disruption of the Ad Business and Everything Else, published by Penguin Press. In the book, Mr. Aletta talks about how clients, advertising companies, and media agencies are all coordinating with or competing against each other, and how the advertising business lost much of its ability to inform and influence consumers. Ken, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So to begin with, what is a frenemy in this context that you're writing about?
Frenemy is someone who is both your friend or partner and your competitor. That is to say, if you're an ad agency, a frenemy is PR agencies that used to just do public relations are now increasingly getting into the advertising business, competing against you. Your clients or the publishing platforms, New York Times, BuzzFeed, et cetera, which is where you place your ads, mm-hmm. increasingly becoming ad agencies, bypassing the agencies. The clients taking more and more stuff in-house, so that your client, but they're also your competitor. The consulting companies like Deloitte that used to be your accountant is now competing against you as an ad agency. But the biggest frenemy, the one that poses the existential threat to all of advertising, not just to the agencies themselves, is the public. The public, particularly on their cell phones, doesn't like being interrupted by ads. And who gave you permission? I don't want to listen to a 30-second or watch a 30-second spot. Banner ads, pre-rolls, I hate them. So stop annoying me.
Right.
And 20% of Americans have on their cell phones what's called an ad blocker, meaning no ads can get through.
Mm-hmm. So many sort of iterations of frenemy, if you will, in terms of this discussion. And I think that last one is perhaps one of the more important that we should discuss in detail. But before that, this thing you said about clients sort of developing this frenemy relationship with the ad agencies is probably one of the places where we've seen some of the more of the disruption, yeah? That they've taken this stuff in-house.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, if you go to the New York Times, for instance, the New York Times has a sales force of roughly 300 people. One-third of them are creating ads. They're an ad agency inside the New York Times. So they're bypassing the agencies that are they're trying to procure ads from.
Right.
It's a fascinating thing, but that threatens the ad agencies, and basically they're treating the ad agency like a extraneous middleman. But again, the real threat to both the New York Times and the agency is the public themselves.
And is the bottom line there that that's just more cost effective for the New York Times, or are there other factors going into that decision to bring it in-house?
Well, they're trying to create another revenue stream. I mean, if you're a newspaper, you know, your ads are drying up. In many cases, not in the case of the New York Times, but many newspapers, they can't raise subscription prices, so their circulation is falling. So they're saying, how else do we generate new revenues? We do events, we do boat trips, et cetera, but let's become an ad agency too.
Mm-hmm. You're right, today advertising and marketing are under assault. Are they under assault, or is the landscape just evolving into a new phase, or both?
Both.
Yeah. So in a way, it's sort of disruption, but it's also innovation, right, happening at the same time.
It is, but if in fact, I mean, if you consider advertising and marketing, it's a $1 to $2 trillion worldwide industry. Without it, there are no newspapers, there are no magazines, many TV would perish. Facebook is 97% reliant on advertising. Google almost 90% reliant. Apps are reliant. The internet is reliant. So if advertising is disrupted and people don't want to tune into advertising, think about all the industries that collapse because of that.
Speaking of other industries, in your book, Three Blind Mice, you write about three major TV networks getting sidelined by new innovation, cable. This was some time ago. Does that story run parallel to how digital has disrupted today's media industry?
Oh, absolutely. When I wrote about Googled in 2009, which you mentioned earlier, Google was disrupting, you know, traditional media, but that's part of the digital revolution. It is now extending to advertising. Advertising was very late to get into this game of disruption, but now it's happening at warp speed, and with consequences for all the industries that advertising supports.
Why do you think advertising was late to this game or to this sort of new landscape?
First of all, the digital revolution that was disrupting the analog industries, the legacy media, all of them were digital as well as analog was dependent on advertising revenues. But at some point, people are always trying to figure out how do we get rid of the middleman, the extraneous cost of the middleman, as they would call it.
Right.
And advertising agencies become an extraneous middleman, but so too does advertising itself. If you have ad blockers that say we won't watch ads, or think about, if you have a PVR, Nielsen says that 55% of the public that records a program on television skips the ads.
Right.
That's extraordinary.
Right.
And then, of course, Netflix doesn't have ads.
So there are more platforms than ever to engage with customers. Does that mean more reach, or does it mean splitting into niche micro demographics?
Niche.
Yeah.
Essentially, if you have more choices, I mean, it used to be when I wrote my book, you mentioned earlier, Three Blind Mice, which came out in 1991. In the 70s, 9 out of 10 people who were watching television at night were watching only one of three networks, ABC, CBS, or NBC. Today, roughly a third, 3 out of 10 are doing it. Why? Because they have many more choices that they didn't have then. And the same is true, instead of newspapers, you go online, you have podcasts, you have blogs, you just have lots more sources of information. Now, that means that has real consequences, say, for news, because you don't have a common set of facts anymore. It used to be we'll turn on to the New York Times or Walter Cronkite, and these are the facts. But now everyone, you can choose your own facts based on if you go to Fox or you go to MSNBC.
Choosing our own facts. It seems to be all the rage these days. I'm D.W. Gibson speaking with Ken Auletta about his new book, Frenemies, The Epic Disruption of the Ad Business and Everything Else, published by Penguin Press. You write, the advertising industry collectively worries that what they think of as their art, big creative ideas, will be replaced by machines weaponized with data and algorithms and artificial intelligence. Isn't Apple an effective example of merging big creative ideas with artificial intelligence?
Apple, I think the point I was making applies much more to Facebook and Google, in the sense that they are engineering-driven companies that are in the advertising business. Apple is really not in the advertising business. They're in the hardware business, and they do a brilliant job of selling you luxury goods at very steep prices. But they don't collect the kind of data that Google and Facebook do. Facebook and Google engineers that rule those companies are basically saying, we can create ads, we can massage the data and figure out how to target ads at specific individuals, and we don't need the madmen, we don't need the people, we're the math men, and we can pull this off. But of course, what happens is, then we saw that in the 2016 presidential election, they were abused, and ultimately, you want a world where madmen have a role, and people who rely on instincts and judgment, not just on mathematical formulas, or don't treat advertising or messaging as a science, because it's not a science.
Instinct, that's a very important word, it seems, because the whole sort of madmen, Don Draper sort of narrative we're given is about instinct, right? Sort of being able to clue in on what people might want. But this transition to algorithms, to math men, as you call them, is quite substantial. Is it something about sort of science guiding art or some sort of major shift in that regard?
The belief of math men, I'm talking about the engineers at companies like right. Google and Facebook, is that they can make this a science. And that if we have enough data about people, we can figure out the mysteries of why people behave as they do and what kind of an ad motivates them to buy your product. And that's their belief. And they're betting on that. And the madmen say, no, it's not a science. But the truth is, it's both. And will we ever get to a point where the machines can predict absolute behavior? I don't believe so. But beyond that, if you could, the more they know about you, the more it elevates the issue of privacy. How do you know so much about me? For instance, one of the things that, they believe in the future, the math men, and actually the madmen agree, hope this is true. They say that if we know who you are and we know what your behavior or your purchasing history is, Ken, you're walking down the street, we have your GPS so we can locate where you are on your cell phone. You're walking by Barney's, Ken, and we know that 2 months ago you bought a blazer at Barney's. If you go into Barney's now, only two blocks away, Ken, we'll give you 20% off. And so the question is, how does Ken respond to that? Does Ken say, wow, this is a great bargain, this is an enticement for me? Or does Ken say, how the hell do you know so much about me? What about my privacy? And that's one of the fundamental questions of the future. Will the privacy issue kick in? Because the more, it's a seesaw. The more you know, the more the seesaw goes up, the more you can target, the more privacy protection goes down. The more privacy protection goes up, the more targeting goes down.
That example you gave of buying the blazer 2 months ago makes me realize is the possibility of the science, the math men remembering purchases we made that we might have actually forgotten about. But, you know, companies like Dove and Adidas have very curated, social conscious, idea-driven ads still, right? And campaigns, in their campaigns. Isn't that art still part of the important engagement with consumers?
Well, actually, part it is, but there's also another angle to why they're doing that. If you think about it, most products, soap, dishwasher, they're commodity products. So how do you differentiate between those commodity products? One of the things, and knowing that people are tired or fatigued with your ads, one of the things that advertisers are increasingly doing is trying to create a halo effect around their product, that we do good. You know, we're environmentally, we serve the environment, you know, where our food is healthful, et cetera. So increasingly, they're trying to do that in order to create a halo effect. It's not just about, you know, the instinct. It's about sales.
And do you feel like the people on the creative side, the madmen, threatened by sort of this new collaboration with science and mathematics, or do they, in general terms, receive it as sort of increased opportunity?
They're terrified. There's a tremendous amount of anxiety in the advertising world because they see the surgeons of Google and Facebook who don't share all of their data and are increasingly bypassing the agencies and going directly to the clients. And they're worried about that. They're worried about how that is disrupting them. But they're also worried that if you get to a world where it's all about math and about science, then the math men will decide we can create the ads. Our machines can create the ads. In fact, the ads may just be instant messages. Mm-hmm. Knowing my behavior history and this is what we do. So the idea of a big idea, they fear, will be kaput.
So there's, I mean, it presents the opportunity for growth on the surface, but it's this inherent, I think, prevailing fear that we see across industries that sort of the human touch, as it were, can be usurped by the algorithms.
Oh, if you're in the ad business, you're like someone in the taxi business or someone in the hotel business. You worry that you're being disrupted by fundamental forces beyond your control. And so I, in the 3 years I spent reporting this book, I was just stunned by the amount of anxiety I would encounter and insecurity. And then you get to a basic question. I had the same encounter when I was doing other books about disruption, be it Google or Three Blind Mice. There are two types of people. There's someone who leans back and says, oh, woe is me. They're doing these terrible things to me. I don't know. What am I going to do? And then there's a person who leans forward and says, this is not a problem. This is an opportunity. And I'm going to try and figure it out. I'm going to throw stuff against the wall and see what sticks. And the smarter person is the person who's leaning forward and throwing stuff against the wall, but it may not stick.
I'm D.W. Gibson, and I'm speaking with Ken Auletta, author of Frenemies, The Epic Disruption of the Ad Business and Everything Else, published by Penguin Press. You're listening to Midday on WNYC. We'll be right back after a break. I'm D.W. Gibson, speaking with Ken Auletta about his new book, Frenemies, The Epic Disruption of the Ad Business and Everything Else, published by Penguin Press. Let's talk about behavioral attributes. What are they? In advertising terms, I guess.
Again, this is data they collect on individuals and about their behavior, what they tend to like, what they tend to, things they purchase, what they tend to read or watch on television. The more, it's basically data about the behavior of individuals.
So, and how does a big entity like Facebook use this data for its users?
They use the target ads, and they know what you like. They know who your friends are. They know what you discuss. And the idea is that we can target ads at those people. They know, for instance, if you're what your income level is. They know whether you own a luxury car. So if you're a luxury car maker, you know, BMW, Mercedes, et cetera, you say, God, I would love to have access to, can you give me access to 1 million people who have luxury cars? Of course we can. And you target them.
How? I mean, some of those details, those attributes are understandable. You might communicate them in messages you post or whatever, but some of this is really intricate stuff.
Some of it is. I mean, increasingly, the machines, they're going to do eyeball recognition and facial recognition, and what you, how long you spend on ad. They can do that right now, how long you spend on an ad, how long you spend on reading something. I mean, they could do that right now. But eventually, they're hoping to do things like facial recognition and eyeball recognition to know really your level of interest in that ad or that piece of information.
Tell us who Michael Kossin is and how he gained the trust of some of the biggest companies in the world. Interesting middleman.
Well, if you think about the point I tried to make before about how the anxiety and insecurity in the industry, one of the reasons that someone like Michael Kossin and MediaLink, his company, is so successful, they give a sense of security to people who are insecure. They say, hey, you want to meet clients? We represent many of the clients you want to meet. You want to meet platforms or publishers? We represent the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, you know, Disney, et cetera. You want to meet Google and Facebook? We represent them, or Microsoft, we represent them as well. So they are a connector to all of these disparate institutions.
He's
and companies.
A broker of sorts. Yeah.
He's a broker, and oftentimes at a negotiation where the client is sitting with the publisher and sitting with the agency, a three-way negotiation, he's at that table. He represents all three of them.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, and so when someone says to Michael Kossin, he said, you know, you kiss all these people. You know, why should I feel comfortable with that? He said, if you want a really good kisser, you hire me.
And so, good kissing aside, why would he be? How does he gain that trust? I mean, how does he work across so many different sectors?
Well, he claims that he doesn't reveal secrets of one side to the other side. He's a charming character, which is one of the reasons I made him such a central character. He's got a great sense of humor. He does represent everybody. He's been in the business a very long time. And people do trust him. I mean, he's a likable fella.
And he's being paid by all parties.
By all parties, and a lot of money.
Right. So in 2015, there's a really a striking scene you paint to open the book with. John Mandel accused the advertising industry of something. What did he accuse them of?
He basically said that the holding companies, the advertising holding companies, there are five giant holding companies that dominate much of advertising. And he said they do business for their own account. They're frenemies with their own clients in the sense that they will buy time at a lower rate and then hold it for a period of time as an investment and then sell it at a higher rate to the publishing companies. And he claimed, John Mandel claimed, this was thievery. And they claim this is allowed in the contract and you know, we're making an investment, taking a risk too, but we have to figure out new ways to make money too.
And so how did that end up, sort of those comments he made at a industry event, how did they end up affecting the big agencies?
He spoke to the ANA, National Advertising, and then was the client side. This was in March of 2015. And he said he made this speech and he made very dramatic charges in that speech about fraud. And it helped trigger a lot of what's called agency reviews. And this is where Michael Kossin came in.
Right.
But essentially what they said, the clients upset, worried about whether they were being wronged by the holding companies, said, we're going to review whether we want to dump our agency and replace our agency with another agency and maybe have a stronger contract. That's where Michael Kossin and MediaLink came in because he then represented many of the clients that were doing these agency reviews.
Mm-hmm. You know, a few weeks ago, we had Jaron Lanier on the program making a case for deleting social media accounts. And a big part of his argument is that we've moved away from being subjected to advertisements in a more traditional sense, a 30-second spot on television, a quarter-page ad in a newspaper, into a whole new realm where we might think we're getting news or having a social interaction. But really, there's some sort of stealth consumption messaging worked into that. It seems as though advertising used to have this sort of section of our lives, but it's really integrated into our lives in a way that we might not necessarily always be aware of.
Well, one of the things that, starting in around 2016, if you went to publishing platforms like the New York Times or BuzzFeed or Vice, et cetera, they would increasingly be talking about something called native advertising, which they saw as a stealth form of advertising that would actually get around ad blockers and appeal to people because it wouldn't be a hard sell. And what is a native ad? A native ad is like an advertorial of old. It's basically a story that is crafted about Unilever or Procter & Gamble or Tide. And they don't mention the product that much, but they tell the story and hopefully suck the reader into that story. And it's written in print. It looks like a news story, but it's really an ad. And there's a little on the top, a little native ad or advertorial, but essentially it's a form of trickery to get around the ad blockers, but also to get around the suspicion and the skepticism that the public has about advertising. That has not done, native ads has not done as well as anticipated for lots of reasons, including it's very hard to scale. You can't, it's not like a 30-second ad that runs again and again and again. You read the story once, how many times do you want to read it? So that's part of a problem. But nevertheless, that was the dream, that it would be a new form of advertising and successful. But that's one of many things that people think about of how to get around the skepticism of the public or the hostility of the public towards a hard sell.
And in the example of native advertising, you said it hasn't taken off like people anticipated, a lack of scalability on the one hand, but also has the public become more smarter? Have they sort of seen that little line that identifies it as advertising and stepped away from it, you think? Or?
They may, I don't know. I think lack of scaling is a bigger problem with native ads. But the public is certainly, I mean, just think about the choices we have today. Look at Netflix. You can not only don't you get ads, but you can watch it when you want. You don't have to wait till Thursday night at 9 o'clock for the show to go on. And you watch as much as you want, and you watch on any device you want. And HBO, same thing. So at some point, that conditions you to think, hey, my God, I don't have to put up with advertising. On the other hand, when you say, I don't have to put up with advertising, if you get rid of advertising, what are the economic consequences for the media industry? Big issue.
I'm D.W. Gibson speaking with Ken Aletta about his book, Frenemies, The Epic Disruption of the Ad Business and Everything Else, published by Penguin Press. Vogue editor-in-chief and the late Diana Vreeland once said, you're not supposed to give people what they want. You're supposed to give them what they don't know that they want yet. So who's in control now? Are consumers now dictating the market because, we've mapped out their individual choices and they can sort of control things in that way? Or is it some hybrid where it's Big Brother environment that we're operating in and we've lost all control?
The consumer is much more in control than advertisers would like. In the early days of television, they had the remote control.
Right.
That gave them a level of control. But that cell phone gives you enormous control and your ability to tune out to things. And then the proliferation of choices, including non-advertising choices, just adds to that. Now, essentially, the madmen and mathmen join forces in wanting to upset the consumer control to regain some control, because they want the business to succeed. It's very natural they would want to do that. So in one sense, there is a kind of tug of war that goes on between the consumer and the advertiser. But the consumer is winning that right now, and technology empowers them to win that.
How did ads transform from points of consumption by consumers during the Mad Men era to annoyances to be avoided? I mean, are there actual hash marks that you can point to?
Well, I don't think there's any hash mark that, well, first of all, start with television. If you watch television programs today, basically roughly 19 minutes of every hour are interruptions. So you're in the middle of watching a drama, and then it breaks for you know, 2 or 3 minutes. And you kind of go crazy, particularly when you compare it to HBO or Netflix or Showtime, which doesn't do that
right
to you. And if you're a creative person, you say, hey, if I can actually create for Netflix or HBO and I don't have to worry about commercial breaks, ups and downs in my story, and people can watch it the way they read a novel and all of it at once, isn't that kind of great? So that becomes a problem. But the bigger disruption came with the advent of the cell phone.
Mm-hmm.
If you think about that cell phone, that button allows you to kick it off or to skip or to go to something else. And increase, if you think about a cell phone is really the most personal device you have. It's as personal as your wallet or your purse. And suddenly someone is buzzing you and interrupting what you're doing for an ad or an instant message, and you didn't invite them to do it. It's not your friend. Who gave you permission to do that? So the cell phone, because it's so personal, intrusions are much more, you know, illustrative. You're much more aware of them. And you say, stop. Mm-hmm. I don't want any more of this.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what's happened.
And you've referenced Netflix and HBO and those sorts of platforms a few times here, which reminds me of the point you make about subscription services. You actually don't necessarily believe that that's a sustainable way to go. Talk a little bit about that.
I mean, the one thing that Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump agreed on in the 2016 presidential campaign is that the American working class, the middle class, the bulk of the American population, their income had been frozen for the last 10 years. The average American spends roughly $260 a month on subscriptions, not counting gas and electricity. So how is that person going to be able to replace advertising with subscriptions? 2.2 billion people are going to pay for Facebook.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to pay for your Google search. You're going to pay totally for the New York Times or for CBS. It ain't going to happen. I mean, it's a nice idea, and it would lessen the power of advertisers, but it's a pipe dream.
Is it, I mean, just to push back on that a little bit in terms of the notion of a pipe dream, is there not a reality where people could just decide to consume less or from fewer outlets and make a commitment to this one or that one?
That's happening. I mean, you see the slim bundles in cable. You see people fleeing cable bundles, expensive cable bundles, and you see them putting together a Netflix
right.
And you look at Amazon Prime, even when they raise the price by $20, you know, they're still doing it. They got great. Or Apple apps,
right?
Great. They're doing great. But that's, you know, that is not going to, you're not going to have a universal replacement by subscriptions for advertising. I mean, it's just people don't have that kind of disposable income. And so, I mean, I just think there's a math problem here.
Right. Well, when you look back to sort of more traditional media outlets like CBS, you know, 1990s, 100% of CBS's revenue came from advertising. Today, only 46% does. How are television companies or more traditional companies recouping that loss?
Well, CBS actually is making more money today than they did 10 years ago, but that's in part because government regulations shifted. They created the Cable Act in 1992, which compelled cable companies to pay subsidies to CBS or ABC or other television stations and networks for their programming. If a cable company wants to run CBS, they have to pay something called retransmission consent. Last year was $1 billion for CBS just from that.
Wow.
Then in 94, the government passed what's called FinCEN rules, allowing the cable networks to own programmings and sell them. That's another $1 billion plus. And then Netflix comes along and Apple and Amazon, and suddenly they have a digital platform to sell to. That becomes another source
right
of income that they didn't have 10 years ago or 20 years ago. The problem is, if you think about Netflix, you're making money from Netflix if you're CBS, and I write about this in the book, but you've created a friend enemy.
Mm-hmm.
You're basically building them up by giving them your programming.
It really is an interesting landscape in that regard, with just all of these entities trying to suss out their relationships with each other and get cozy, but also keep distance at the same time. So, I mean, I think it's safe to say that media in general is evolving.
Totally.
Yeah.
Totally. And not just advertising, but all media is evolving.
Right.
But they can't evolve fully, most media, without advertising support. They need that revenue stream. And that revenue stream is potentially threatened.
You mentioned some changes to in government regulations that have helped entities like CBS, but are there companies getting it right in their own on their own terms who are thriving in the changing market that you would point to?
Well, you could argue that, that Facebook and Google are thriving, but I think one of the questions, and I raise this in the book, there's a real question about the 800-pound government gorilla. There is a real danger for the digital giants that the government will step in and say, hey, wait a second, you have kind of monopoly power that we brought Microsoft to trial for in 2000 and found them guilty of monopolistic behavior. Or what do you do about privacy? We're going to impose some regulations about to prevent you from exploiting the privacy of American citizens the way they've done in Western Europe. Or maybe we're going to prevent you, Facebook, let's say, from buying potential competitors to you, as they did with Instagram, et cetera.
Right.
So the idea that government regulations could step in and address those to deal with the power of the Facebooks and the Googles and the Amazons and the Apples is a real potential threat to those companies, which they have always been insensitive to and unaware of. But now if you look at who's spending money on campaign contributions or on lobbyists, some of the biggest spenders are companies like Google and Facebook and Amazon.
Right. So it seems like advertisements now have a way of entering popular conversation in a way that they haven't in the past. Take, for example, the Pepsi ad with Kendall Jenner. Why did that backfire like it did?
It was a stupid ad. I mean, essentially the ad said that if you a protest, a Black Power protest, a Black Lives Matter protest, if you join the protest, if you just hand a Pepsi to a cop, you make peace with them. I mean, it was a silly ad. I mean, and in fact, the guy who helped create it and was the CMO at Pepsi soon after lost his job.
Right. That sounds like it might be a good example of large demographic demonstrating their power.
I don't know whether it's large. It was just silly. Well, first of all, you could argue that that went viral. The ad went viral, but so did the protest against the ad. And the internet obviously allows that to happen. And it was an ad that was originally appeared in digital form. It was supposed to graduate to television. It never did.
Yeah.
Because of the viral protest.
And sort of consumers.
And Martin Luther King's daughter tweeted.
Right.
Said if Daddy only knew, he could have handed out Pepsis.
Right. His daughter and consumers writ large saying we don't want to participate in this. Right.
That's right.
Have you gotten feedback from the industry so far on the book? Any reactions?
Well, I did an interview with Martin Sorrell, Sir Martin Sorrell, who lost his job recently as the head of the largest holding company in Cannes, where I was last week for the big advertising confab. And it was a lot of talk about it. Yeah, and they said, well, one of the criticisms, and he lodged this against me in our on-stage talk last week, he said, you don't celebrate advertising enough in your book. And I said, I'm a journalist, not a cheerleader. I'm not here to celebrate.
Well, it's a fascinating read, and I'm so grateful that you've been here today to discuss it with us.
Thank you.